Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a UnitedHealthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
If you love the Mixing Music podcast but want deeper, ad-free, technical episodes, we've got you covered. Our Patreon gives you access to over 250 exclusive episodes and new content every single week, all focused on mixing, mastering, and engineering at a high level. For just $4 a month, you get practical tips and techniques that will instantly improve your sound. Join now at mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive. Hello, welcome back to the Mixing Music Podcast. I'm your host, DK, and with me today, as always, is my lovely co-host, Let's Get Mixin' Lou.
You know, I did not think you were going to say mixin' after my last joke I told you.
Wait, I don't get it. It's all right, whatever. Let's
it's
get
probably
mixin'
best
Lou.
You don't say it.
Yeah, and then... Let's get it started, huh? All right. That just totally reminds me. Remember how Black Eyed Peas came out with that song?
Yeah.
I, to this day, still don't know if the original lyrics are Let's Get It Started, because I remember hearing a version that says Let's Get Retarded, huh?
Okay, so I'm not going to lie. I always thought it was Let's Get Retarded. And then I heard... Let's Get It Started. And I'm like, is there a radio version? Is there like alt versions depending on where it's being played?
I don't know if it's the radio version.
Yeah.
It is retarded.
Yeah. So maybe when things got appropriated, or not appropriated, but you know, when they were trying to be a bit more appropriate, they're like, maybe we shouldn't say that as much. Maybe we should have a lyric switch up depending on the network.
Yeah, Let's Get It Started is the clean version.
Okay.
Oh,
okay, I got it.
Wow, you're right. Okay.
My ears did not deceive me, but your hunch was on it.
Yes. All right, well, let's get restarted, yeah. With Lou. Huh. Let's get mixing, Lou. All right. Today we have a topic that came from a question that I think is good to talk about. Mm-hmm. Is the idea of, like, I mix, especially, this was asked to me directly. But I think we could both extrapolate or expound on this is someone asked me, like, DK, back in the day, I used to mix a lot of like rap records, a lot of hip hop rap records, like 3, 4, 5 years ago, up until about 3 years ago. It was an old intern that's about to finish graduate school. And she asked, like, you used to mix a lot of like these records here, and now I know you do a lot of like other stuff, diverse stuff. What is, like, do you approach these records differently? Do you mix these records differently across genres? And my answer was quite simple. It was, no, I don't approach them differently. I do mix them slightly differently, but the approach is always the same. And to be short, it was the fact that, like, emotionally, I listen to the song and I do what I think it needs emotionally. Mm-hmm. Now, things like that technically, like emotionally putting like a bus compressor on a rap song doesn't work as well as like a rock song. Mm-hmm. And like super mixing into that bus compressor on a rock song feels totally different and feels appropriate for a rock song, but does not feel appropriate for a hip hop song. Yeah. Being able to recognize between the two, things like that, right? So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Like, we'll talk a little bit about our general approaches. And we will talk a little bit about some technical specific stuff that we do or don't do at this current point in time. Mm-hmm. Lou, tell me about your approaches and how they're the same across different genres, both in a live and studio setting.
Okay. I was actually going to bring up
also how they're different too. Go ahead.
So you already know, I grew up as kind of like a rock guy that also listened to a lot of hip hop. And one of our fun ways of bonding when we first met and started hanging out, when we first started in the mix and all that, was like me showing you records that I was like, you really don't know this song? You don't know this song? And it would be like West Coast, like very like LA centric artists, you know, which makes sense, you know, but at the same time, I was listening to like old R&B, like listening to Motown records. I liked listening to like heavy metal. And then when I started actually like working in music like heavily, it was a lot of hip hop that was hiring me more than anything. And it was the genre that I actually not necessarily didn't want to work in the most, but I was more into rock as a pathway. So live sound actually opened me up to a lot of rock stuff, and I got to work with a lot of bands there. But when it came to like getting booked in studios, like actually working at a different rooms, a lot of the hip hop guys were the ones booking me the most often. So there was a big tell difference early on, which was like the kick drum is approached very differently in rock versus like hip hop, where like in rock, you might want like a tight, really fast attack, low sustained kick. Well, in hip hop, sometimes it's actually really nice to have like a more pillowy hitting kick with a longer sustain, because you want that speaker to rumble kind of thing. And that's very, very apparent when you listen to like G-funk hip hop versus like a standard alternative rock band, let's say like Linkin Park, where Linkin Park might use like synth bass in the background to create that big filling sound, but the drums are very differently approached than in like a hip hop record. So recently working with like Exhibit Live, you know, he's kind of known for the Dr. Dre era of hip hop. But he's now traveling with a rock band, you know? So the funny thing is like, it's meshing rock music into hip hop and trying to preserve those two sides of the elements. Right. But it's kind of funny. There is a juggle on how to deliver, like we want it to still be hip hop, but we want some of that aggression of the live band, but it's not supposed to be a rock show. It's supposed to be a hip hop show. So how do you get electric guitars, dual stack keyboards, a live drum set with like five toms on it and everything, and a DJ and a bass player, synth bass all going together, and not make it sound like you've overly gone into the other genre? Or if you're trying to make it more like the other genre, what elements do you keep and what elements do you take away? You know, so low end is usually a big one for me. Low end is very indicative, where like on Trunk Shakers, you know, we want that thick low end, but we also might saturate it so it could be heard like on a phone, right? While in rock, a lot of times that bass tone isn't necessarily rumble. It's almost like supportive of guitars, depending on how the bass is actually played. While in hip hop, bass is kind of leading over any guitar.
Yeah.
You know, the guitar might actually have its own space and role, but they usually are completely separate roles that don't need to occupy a similar range. While in rock, you hear a lot of bass players who use distortion to actually go more hand in hand with the guitarist. And when they do lead off, they're not looking for completely distorted tones to actually be leading off with. There's a balance between clean low end and distorted low mids from a bass player in rock versus in, like, let's say soul R&B stuff. It's very smooth bass with very clean playability, and that cleanliness needs to translate as they move up the scale.
Yeah, exactly. To your point, like the low end is foundational across genres too, and even across eras. Like how the low end sounds in a Stevie Wonder record sounds totally different than like a modern day Dua Lipa record.
Or how the hi-hats are approached.
Yeah, even the hi-hats, which is kind of funny, because like that might be the one thing that is kind of similar from then and now, as far as like, but it's just different genres, like trap to Stevie Wonder. Still mostly hi-hats. Anyway, let's talk about, just real quickly, I want to define mixing style. Is that cool? I want to structure this a little bit better, and I want to structure our future episodes a little bit more, but like mixing style, what does that even mean? Is that like tone? Is that taste? Is that tool set? Is it like order of operations, workflow? Is it like cooking? Is it the way that you process and cook Mexican food, or is it the way that you process Japanese food, or is it the food itself? Right. I think there's a difference between style and tools.
Mm-hmm.
For example, even if like approach, I think is a better word than style. Like food is food, even across cultures. Japanese food, Mexican food, you approach it the same, which is you want that food to have the customer feel something to, one, first off, enjoy it.
Yeah.
Right? Second off, really taste the background and like the story behind it. Like an emotion, like you want it to be emotionally transcendent, right? To a certain degree. And I'm kind of going a little bit beyond what I understand about food here. But the tools are relatively the same. Even in Japanese food, like we still use a knife, you know? And the knife might be different, but it's still a knife.
Yeah.
You know, of different sizes and we have specialty tools and stuff. So I think it's the same. The approach is still similar and the same. It's all for the customer, which in our case with mixing, it's all about thinking about the consumer at the end of the day. This is the one thing that I think that most engineers and producers in the early stages kind of forget about, which is remembering the consumer. Now, there's a balance to this. You don't want to do things for the consumer specifically, and then in the midst of doing things for the consumer, become a slave to your own style and lose all authenticity and ingenuity, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want to do that. But you do want to remember, like, what this works, how this works, why Spotify exists. And like, for example, like Spotify exists because it makes finding music and playing music easy for the consumer. So how do you take advantage of that? How do you use Spotify in a way that works for their best interests and your best interests? And how do you like monetize their algorithm by understanding who their algorithm is for? Stuff like that, right? In the same way, like emotionally with the song, they might not understand specifically, like when you write a song about a breakup, for example, they might not understand specifically your breakup story, but most of an audience can understand, especially the target demographic, would be able to understand the general, the general idea. There'd be a consensus of how it feels to go through a breakup and how bittersweet that is, or whatever feelings that you want to evoke, right?
Mm-hmm.
Invoke. So you need to first think about the emotion and the portrayal of the song. Like there's no point of mixing, because like mixing it to make it sound good is not the goal. That's what I'm talking about here. Like to make it sound good is not the goal. It's to make it enjoyable to the listener.
Yeah.
And then usually to make it enjoyable to the listener does involve some sort of making it sound good, but then good becomes completely relative to the song and the intended emotion and the story being told.
A good example of this is if you were to think about like our approach is influenced by the audience in the same way that for a show when they're booking artists, they might look at the artists that are performing and say, do these even, you know, relate to each other at all. You know, if you want to dance Gavin Dance, like a hardcore band to come out and play and you put them on a bill with Britney Spears, you'd be like, that's really weird. Why are we doing that? So you wouldn't necessarily use the same approach that the guy mixing Britney is on Dance Gavin Dance. You know, so when you're thinking about the audience, it's not necessarily because we want to sell out to an audience, but the people that are consuming the music also have things that they're kind of used to hearing and that don't necessarily translate from other genres if they were to be applied. So you kind of also have to like take a listen and understand who you're delivering it to and what that typically sounds like and why it sounds that way. For instance, there's G-Funk has lots of like really rumbly low end, while other hip hop genres may have like a tighter low end. But G-Funk's big tell is that low end. You know, so if you were to mix a G-Funk record versus other hip-hop records, though they are part of the same overall genre, it's a subgenre that has certain tells. And you have to kind of be able to translate that. So it's less about like selling out, but rather our approach to the same material.
Yeah, and there's a lot of things like outside of the realm of mixing that matter with low end too, like G-funk versus reggae. Reggae is very important. Yeah. Like the low end is super important too, but it does feel different.
Yeah.
But that's also with like the notes and the rhythms like the, and the BPMs and stuff. Yeah. So that might be slightly different, but we're specifically talking about mixing, even with G-funk, where it's more of like a rhythmic bass.
Yeah.
In reggae, it's more of like an overblown sub, like subby bass. Right?
And a lot of times it's actually like real electric bass versus like a synth bass, you know, and how you would approach the instrumental difference.
No, I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves, but that is partially because of like, not because a subby low end feels more relaxed and like reggae-y, you know, that might partially be because of the lack or like just the culture of the genre and the feeling of nostalgia that comes with the genre. Like this feels like reggae because of the overblown bass. And that overblown bass might have existed because, you know, they originally were mixing the shit on like really bad speakers. So they over pushed the bass to make up for the bad speakers when they're, you know, for the first few reggae songs. Doesn't really matter. Or like, you know, whatever culturally the sound was to the, not the mechanical, to the technical deficiencies at the time. Like
everybody was just on NS10s, no bass at all, so they pushed it.
Yeah, like a Stevie Wonder song going straight to vinyl, or old songs going straight to vinyl didn't even have the technical possibility to overblow the bass, you know, because vinyl can't do that. So things like that, you know, so there's things like that, but that leads to feelings of that genre now. Like, why do things feel old and feel new, or like a modern take on an old song, like or an old take on a new song even. So there's a lot of things that we could talk about there. And then anyway, we're gonna go into this. So number one with mixing, even across all genres, from let's just stick to like rap to like rock, right? That's like a classic trans
Jay-Z, Linkin Park collab.
Trans genre thing that most people will do, especially right now with country music, rock music, and like just bands getting bigger. We can even talk about jazz, which is totally different too. But step one is absolutely always, this is something that I always recommend, I always do, before mixing the song. I will never ever start mixing a song if I do not have the reference demo. I don't care how bad or unprecise or unintentional or mediocre the rough mix is. I don't care how embarrassed the artist is of their own mix and how unrepresentative it is of how they intend the song to be. I want to hear the rough mix.
Yeah.
It is absolutely necessary. Now, a good artist, a good producer will have put some thought, even if it was unintentional, into the rough mix. Like they wouldn't have recorded each individual part soloed to a metronome and then just like, you know, it's not totally random. There was some feel, even if it's a very minor thing, there was some feel put into that rough mix. And I'm trying to use that rough as a guidance to tell me what the intended emotion is. So like, even if it was poorly mixed, I can tell that this first chorus is big, but there's a little bit of emotion and largeness, like bigness, save for the last chorus. This bridge is supposed to be really washy and dreamy and reverby. Even though they like kind of like didn't do the reverby enough, like reverb enough, it was still, but it's still meant to be washy. Or like sometimes even last week I did a song where like the vision of the song was like at the very end, like the sound changed at the very end in the outro of the song. It went from like big stage audience, washy reverb kind of thing with long pre-delay reverb kind of things. And then all of a sudden the outro, it was like intimate, very short, long pre-delay reverbs, room reverbs, to make it feel like they were singing off of a jazz stage, like a small stage. So it's like, I'm also including like the idea of like vision, like where am I hearing this? Like, what is the point of this? And all of that, like the point of the stage was to invoke that feeling of intimacy in the outro, right? So like emotion of the song. What does, and usually the track wants to feel something, wants to portray something. Something that you hear me and Lou talk about is the song tells you what it wants to do often. Yeah. Even if the artist and the producer sucks at mixing, the song will, and if you are a good mixer, you will be able to tell and read the story of the song. The song will tell you. And that's like the part of the job of the mixer is to understand. This is why mixing is such a creative emotional skill set. is because you have to be somewhat of an empath. I know that sounds a little funny, but like you have to be somewhat of an empath as a mixer to understand where the artist was coming from, what the song wants to do, all from like a possibly the shittiest rough mix you've ever heard ever. Right. And then you have to use technical things like tension, contrast, space, focus, levels, compression, density, you know, with these more technical things to invoke that intended emotion. So like, I'm sure that you have a lot of real world stories about this.
Yeah.
But again, one story that I talk about often is one time I had interns mixing a song and then I was mixing a song and I just showed them how lowering the volume of the drum bus, like 2 or 3 dBs
mm-hmm.
in the across the entire song, totally changed the feel of the song. It was subtle. Like if you were A-B-ing it like we were, you could hear a difference. But if you weren't A-B-ing it, you wouldn't even be able to tell. But in that moment when we were A-B-ing the version with 2 or 3 dB drop in drums and without it, the song felt different. And to this day, that like sticks out to me as like something so small, like just lowering the volume. It wasn't even a compression thing. Just lowering the volume of the drums 2 to 3 dBs totally changed the feeling of the song. Something that was like more rhythmic and progressive and like aggressive went to a little bit more like 5% more of an easier listening song. 5 to 10% yeah. like easier listening, more calm, more like, okay, this would be played in the back of like a grocery store and it wouldn't bother me.
A good example of like small differences like that making the world of a difference when it comes to genre swapping. I don't know what the swapping is, but vocal volume, even a dB difference. So when I'm mixing X, when he's just with him, Demrick, and Flawless the DJ, when it's just the three of them on stage, of course, just like in hip hop, vocals on top. It's very common, not overly on top where it's just vocal and then a track behind them, but typically vocals on top when it comes to like hip hop, R&B genres. But when it comes to rock genres, vocals are tucked. You know, they're not overly tucked to where you can't hear them, but they're a bit more in pocket with the music. They're part of the instrumentation, so to speak. When he's performing with his band, his vocal approach is actually a little bit different. Like he's still actually performing with a lot more energy, but I have to approach his vocal volume a little bit different. Whenever we're doing stuff, so there's a group that I'll work with once in a while called Vienna Vienna. And the vocalist for that group is super cool, super killer. It's all rock on that one. It's all rock and roll. And so you have this like hard hitting drums, but it's like very like impact focused versus like boom focused. When we have the drums with Exhibit, it's very boom and smack focused. Like the whole like, oh, I want it to smack through the speakers. So like the snare is kind of aggressive, but it's not crackly like a snare in a rock song where you might want a little more chain in it or something that top end like sizzly crack. Like in X's drummer, I'll put like 200 hertz a little bit thicker on his snare so it gets more of that thwack. Versus the snare, I guess, sizzle, you know? So, like, whenever you're blending vocals, depending on the genre, just like the drums, if they have a minor difference between tones, vocal volume, like, even a dB difference in how it sits in the pocket could be genre differences right there. Like, with reggae, you always hear, like, vocals and snare kind of equal in volume. Like the snare really, really stands out. It's almost like a very focal point. So like little ghost notes tend to be pushed up in the mix. That way you can hear every little intricacy in what's going on. In a lot of rock music, those ghost notes get buried by everything else. Like they're there and they want to be heard. But because there's so much mid-range going on and there's so much movement and depending on the pace of the record, whether it's like the difference between a 120 BPM song and a 140 BPM song, it's stuff that can sometimes get buried. So you may not try to overcompress the snare and then it just sounds like bleed is coming through the drums so much. So ghost notes tend to get hidden, but there's so much space in reggae that those ghost notes get to stand out. And in fact, they might get pushed out so they could be a little bit heard and they become part of the vibe, the pacing of the record.
Great. Yeah. So this goes into our next topic, which is technical flexibility within a consistent process.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about what does change across genres. Let's start with like vocals, right?
Mm-hmm.
So pop vocals versus rap vocals versus indie vocals. Even reverb types,
Or the lack or abundance of it.
So you talked about like pop versus rap versus like rock vocals. Mm-hmm. It's one starts with volume, and then there's like textures and density as well. Like indie vocals are meant to be a little bit more dynamic, not crazy, but they're not as dense and they're a little bit more dynamic. Where like rap vocals, like every single, it's all about lyrics. Like every single word has to be on top, like either hyper compressed or automated the hell out of. And then
or parallel.
Yeah, and then pop vocals, however you process it. The point is the quiet, even the quiet, the non-accented words in a lyrical setting, right? But then if it's like a rap song that's supposed to sound punky, you know, that's that now you're blending genres and you're blending the rules. Same with a pop vocal. Pop vocal is possibly a lot of like longer sustained notes, just louder vocals on top. The singer's really good. They're supposed to shine. Right. Let's even talk about like how you approach compression of like trap 808s versus like jazz upright bass. The function of the compressor totally changes. Most of the time with like trap 808s, where it's like 808s are usually sampled without like a huge sense of dynamics. Like unless you have a sampler that has like dynamic changes, usually they're the same volume. So the function of a compressor for a trap 808 is different from the function of an upright bass for jazz, which the upright bass for jazz, the compressor would be to bring out the intricacies of the little slap against the fretboard. The strings against the fretboard would be able to hear every single note, the sustain. But the 808, it might just be the distortion of the compression.
Yeah.
Or like to enhance the initial transient of the compression or to kill the initial transient. The function of it is different, how you approach it based on what it needs as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So like even with across genres, I don't compress differently because it's hip hop. I compress differently because the drums and vocals want to punch me in the face. And the other one wants to like be intimate and whisper in my ear. Like, does that make sense? So that's why it comes back to that emotional process. Mm-hmm. And you have like technical flexibility. Because if you do like cross genres where it's like a like Lil Nas X with like a country pop hip hop song, that's going to be, or like rap vocals over like a punk. Who did that? Like, who does that? Like Machine Gun Kelly. For example, like with like punk music and rap lyrics kind of thing, like how you blend those genres from a sonic perspective matters too. And the attention, the intended emotions change.
Yeah. Yeah. Even the way you approach something as simple as doubles can change with depending on genre. Where like I've noticed like on indie records, when they do like a doubled vocal, it's not like a hip hop double where you tuck it under just so it's audible enough to hear that there's a doubling effect going on, but rather in a lot of indie records, you hear the double being like kind of a co-singer, if that makes sense. Like they're supposed to share in the spotlight, and it's supposed to be more of an emotional delivery and something that's supposed to stand out versus something that's supposed to be subtly tucked under, because they're not going for every lyric. Or like some people will do fill-ins where they might double a couple words here and there. And that's pretty normal in hip hop, but you don't really hear that a lot in rock. So like if you were to hear fill-ins in like rock, they're maybe supposed to still be kind of tucked versus like stand out like in hip hop.
Absolutely. Yeah. So again, just mixing again, style, you got to have technical flexibility or the consistent process, the process being emotional understanding, right?
And intention. Pretty common thing I've noticed is like with like R&B, you want to leave some dynamics, but after a certain like when they belt, like you kind of want to catch the belting because you're not trying to go overly loud, but you also don't want to squash it so much to where it sounds like over compressed R&B vocals. Like there's a certain liveliness that comes with R&B.
Yeah. And even within R&B, it's like if you compress less, it feels older.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
So it's like, there's a difference between like a Chris Brown R&B and like an old, like early R. Kelly R&B. Sorry, no. he might have been canceled, but like still.
My mind's telling me don't compress too hard.
No. Funny. All right, five. Let's talk about like common misconceptions here. One. Let's see here.
Tools are not genre specific.
Yes. Okay. Let's talk about, tools are not genre specific, right? That being said, this is something that is specific to DK. Mm-hmm. I, for some reason or whatever, like the API 550A, 550B doesn't sound like I, for some reason, only use those EQ plugins for rock. I don't use them for hip hop. I don't use them for other genres. I mostly use them just for guitars specifically a lot. I don't know why. In my mind, that's the tool for rock guitars.
Mm-hmm.
Or just guitars in general. This is not because it's better. It's not because it does something specific. I think it's just my mind calibrating and setting aside a tool to for like guitars. Like I've used this for guitars. I don't think it's like the best tool for guitars. It's just something that I've always done. And that's different from doing things because... and I'm still like, don't use the same settings. I'll change the settings based on the song and the genre and how the instrumental is playing with the vocals, et cetera, et cetera. But like, that is an example of like, okay, there is something to be said about like mental offloading and like habit building. And like, that's how I separate different processing and like technical processing for different genres and stuff. But that being said, that's APIs are not better for rock music than it is for jazz music, than it is for hip hop music. It's just my mind making habits. So I do things like that, but I have to keep in mind, like it's the chains are always a different, the EQ points and the boosts and the cuts that I'm doing, not just the frequencies, but how much I'm doing is also going to be different for the song. There's just some familiarity with the tool for that instrument.
Mm-hmm.
Also, like another myth is you have to totally switch up your style for each genre. That's not necessarily true.
Yeah, like I would agree with that. I don't think I could ever categorize what I do when having to deal with different genres as like a complete mentality shift, because I still reach for some of the most commonly used tools and I reach for them for the same reason, but it's my approach that really changes. Like for vocals, I'm always reaching for like Pro Q3 or 4 pretty quickly because it's a tool I know and it's a tool I trust. And it's not that it's the best plugin in the world or anything. It's just the one that gets me working the fastest. So I can focus on why I'm using it versus which tool am I using for this type of genre. You know, so if it just sounds like, oh, these vocals are a little bit boxy, let me just reach out for that. Cool. It's not a genre specific decision. So if I'm reaching for like Voice of God on like bass on a hip hop record, I might be tuning it to a lower resonance. If I'm doing it for a rock record, I might be tuning it up for a higher resonance, but I'm still reaching for the same plugin. You know, it's just that the approach to why I'm using it in a specific way this time is what changed. It's not a complete mentality change. It's not like you have one knife for sushi, another knife for mangoes, and another knife for cutting a sandwich. It's all the same knife, but it's how you approach it and why you would maybe use, like, let's say you're cutting rice. Rice can be sticky sometimes. So if you're cutting through a roll, you might prep the knife a little bit differently, but you're still going to cut. You know, but you maybe just don't.
I think we're getting lost in the comparison. In the.
I like the comparison because it's kind of like, realistically, who wants to spend on a bunch of different tools just to do genre swapping, right? Like, you don't need 5 different strainers. You just need a fucking strainer.
Maybe if we're gonna keep going with this metaphor. I have all sorts of different knives and I use different knives, not because they cut differently, but because how they feel in my hand and just familiarity. Like I cut mangoes, I cut fruits with this knife and not because it's better for cutting fruit or cuts it differently. This is just, I'm just faster with this because I always cut fruits with this and I've sharpened it, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's, I don't know if there's a good metaphor. I'm getting lost in the metaphor sauce. But anyway, here's some practical advice. Yeah. This is really, really important. And there is a proper distinction between these two. Is one, you need to learn genre conventions, but not necessarily become them.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that there's two ways to learn genre conventions. One is obviously listening and expanding your palate as an analyzer of music. So for me, this is going to be a little bit goal dependent. Like if you are going to be a metal mixer, like all you're mixing is you're going to niche into metal rock music, right? then you still need to study all of the subgenres within metal and become an analyst for that. I'm a pop guy, so that means I have a larger library, because pop changes based on the generation and like the current trends of music. I have a larger basis of library that I need to analyze and study from. And I do. I spend, this is something that I've heard other mixers do. Dale Becker talked about how when he was starting, his dad, who was also an engineer, forced him to, like, for the first 10, 15 minutes before every single day, one, listen to songs at the same volume, which is a separate topic here. But number two, listen to like top 40 charts every single day. Just like starting off with 10, 15 minutes, even if it was just like a 10 to 30 second snippet of that song, but just like every day, starting the day, referencing top 40s and understanding like where music trends are going. I think that's like a really good example. Like constantly people, like as mixers, our job is to analyze and create a library, a repertoire of understanding how music works and how it is approached in different genres and different times of different tastes and different eras, etc. But that doesn't mean you must do them. So the second thing that you can learn how to learn genre conventions is to mix them, which is totally different from listening. You can listen to a rock metal kit, drum kit, and songs and how kits are used, but then applying that exact tone in a process that could possibly take hours, where you can lose that taste and lose that sense of objectivity with that drums. Like at the beginning, when you first start, in the first 10 minutes, you know exactly what metal drums sound like. But like if you've been working on the same song for 3 hours, then all of a sudden it's like you kind of accidentally start to forget what metal drums sound like. So you go back to reference. So this is why referencing comes into play. But like it's kind of like language. Learning to understand and listen to Spanish is different from being able to speak it. So anybody that like is like a half or like interracial kid, it's like where a lot of people, it's like, oh, I can understand Spanish, I just can't speak it. Or I can understand Japanese, but I can't speak it. This is the exact reason why like listening and learning music conventions and genre conventions is different from doing them. So you have to mix them too. So I would go out of your way, and I would not, this goes along with some other advice that I've done in other episodes, I would not go online and find free stems to mix for different genres. It's like a last resort. What I would do is reach out to your local friends, local neighbors, people local. That way you have a client, and then offer to mix it for free, right? Because if you're going to practice, the practice of mixing has to be within a realm of feedback. Like there has to be a feedback. That's the only way to practice real mixing. If there's no feedback, no one to actually like check off the mix and say, hey, it's good now, we like it now, you're mixing in a void, and that's not proper practice. It's not proper practice. And so, you need to be, it's like a drummer practicing fills, but not to a metronome. You need to have a metronome. Same thing with like that feedback is what keeps us stable. So number one, learn genre conventions, but don't become them. Number two is everyone's born with taste. My four-year-old Down syndrome son may not be able to technically articulate why he likes this Elmo song and not another Elmo song, but he can tell me that he likes this Elmo song. Everybody has taste. Literally, we kind of, as we learn through the technical process of how to, the technical stuff of this, we kind of forget about our tastes and put them on the back end, which is a normal part of the learning process. But you need to come back and realize that all of those technical tools come down to emotional intuition. And the fact of the matter is there's a lot of beginner mixers or beginner producers that will mix that song better than you as a intermediate mixer will ever be, because they aren't bound by convention. And they're just 100% intuition. And 100% intuition will always sound better than convention. That's just what it comes down to. You should always ask yourself, how should this feel? Not what genre is this? Like, yes, the genre should be taken into consideration, but like just most music, especially if you work with like higher end artists, Most of these like very, in the most polite of ways, I will kind of overgeneralize here. the less experienced an artist is, the less authentic of a voice that they've typically discovered within themselves, which means it's going to stick to a more standard genre. Not always the case, but I find people that don't have as much experience kind of stick to a genre. And then the people that have a lot more experience, that have spent a lot of time learning their own voice and authenticity and their style, will tend to blend things because they're being authentic. Not because that's the purpose necessarily, but there's usually some sort of a blend of different types of different sounds. And yes, that is across the board. There's a difference between being Chris Brown, the first person to really blend the specific style of R&B, trap, pop, hip hop, versus like being the second Chris Brown, which is you're just copying Chris Brown. There's a difference, right? So, so ask yourself, how should this feel? Not what genre this is. And be open to the idea of blending different feels from different genres after you learn them. Mm-hmm. The last advice is, this is so oversimplified, over-reductive. I don't care. It's still really good advice. Is, you as a mixer and as a listener and analyzer of music need to develop taste. Here's the thing. I'm very much against engineers having their own sound. I'm very much against having their own sound. In fact, here's a quote of how much I'm against people having their own sound. This is from Mixer Man from Zen and the Art of Mixing. I always advise against having a sound. For starters, it makes you boring and one-dimensional from a creative standpoint and only serves to elevate your role as more important than the artist. Surprise, it's not. So don't necessarily have a sound for the sake of having a sound. That's not the point. But you need to develop your taste, meaning you need to understand what you like, what you believe expresses this emotion. Mm-hmm. Do you view things as a stage, in a jazz, intimate jazz stage, or in the bedroom versus the sound of on a big, large auditorium? Like, is that how you see things? Do you see things in levels? Like, you intentionally will interpret these tastes and sounds as specific technical tools. And whether you like it or not, you will accidentally have a style.
Yeah.
Right? But the style is specific to you, and you need to develop that.
Yeah.
Cool. Thoughts on that, Lou? On any?
I agree. Something that you mentioned, which was unfortunate but funny because it stood out immediately for me, was like, music, even for the bedroom, is very different. And like, if that was your style, as we know, a lot of like bedroom songs are like very slow, very hard hitting, like kick and snare, lots of washing going on. But if you were to apply that across the board as like your sound, you're the guy that makes that sound. Like, there's a very narrow opportunity for you throughout your career because not everybody's making bedroom music. So being adaptable to different genres and actually saying, you know what, I can actually approach different things in different ways because I've actually opened myself up to listening to the client, listening to their record, and trying to develop it around what they need. Not necessarily my own personal preference, but understanding what their preferences are and trying to deliver on that will get you a lot more work than having a niche sound. And I hate to say it, but bedroom music is not like a massive, massive market as it was maybe a few decades ago, at least not on the same level. But if that's like something that you're going to niche down into, or you're niching into hip hop as a guy that was previously rock, but you're still maintaining all the same chops from your rock side, it's going to be harder for you to get more clients that really enjoy your mixes in hip hop because your approach is just stuck in one realm, you know, versus listening to it, getting to know the genres that you're walking into and actually saying, you know what, let me change a few things that I'm doing to kind of better suit the needs of the listener and the client that's booking me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And to kind of wrap up too, I want to talk about this because I got an email that I need to respond to that I probably will have them on. I got an email for the podcast saying, hey, we'd like to schedule an interview. And the guy made a mixing AI tool. So you send in your stems and your multitracks and it mixes it for you. All of the demos on his website is like shitty music to less shitty. So it's not, it's mostly like leveling stuff. Yeah. Doesn't feel like super big EQ moves or anything like that. But as mixing becomes more AI, this is really important. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, luckily, mixing is a creative process. There is no objectively best mix for the song.
Yeah.
Here it is. If an AI can mix a song for free and even pump out 10 versions of a mix, right?
Mm-hmm.
The artist still has to pick the version that best represents the song.
Yeah.
And there's still some insecurity and indecisiveness that is going to happen when picking which mix works best for the song. And the reason why I'm not afraid of losing my job as a mixer, especially at the level I'm at right now, is not because of technical skill or being able to balance a song. It's because of my emotional intuition and sonic storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And that, even if AI could copy my moves exactly, will not be able to learn one. I think like the accidental mistakes that I make, like when is AI going to learn? Like right now is the best time to make a mistake. Like DK forgot about this, about the kick drum, and now it sounds slightly different and that actually was better, you know? Mm-hmm. There's also things to be said about like emotionality cannot be replicated. And if it can be replicated, how I represent emotion is so different from song to song. Just because an AI can replicate the exact emotion and tension from one song to another doesn't make it better for the second song, right? Yeah. So I am not afraid, because our job, we need to realize our job is actually one of the final frontiers of like music in the creative process. Yes, we do a very highly technical thing that takes years to learn. But at the same time, what separates us from AI is the emotionality of it, and which is why I'm not fearful of AI taking my job. If you are at the lower ring of mixers, you need to learn this. If you are a beginner to intermediate mixer, you are in risk of losing your job to AI, because you are competing based on price and doing a checklist job.
Yeah.
When you are approaching a mix as a checklist, you have very little value, especially compared to AI.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of funny, but I will bounce back a little bit on the last
Please.
Thing, which is the checklist part, because AI is not very good at checklists either. If you give AI revision notes, if it's like a little drawing or something, it usually can fix the one little bit in the drawing. But something that you learn as a mixer is, if you ever get a revision about like, oh, the kick, you only touch the kick. You don't touch anything else. AI, for some reason, will still touch other elements thinking it needs to.
Yeah, but that's sort of
it's making
that
a lot of
better.
Amateur mistakes. Yeah, it'll get better over time, but like, It's going to be interesting when you get a note. It's like, oh, can the reverb be a little bit tighter on the vocal? And it might not come out exactly as you want, or it might change the mix approach to it. It might change like the EQ to make the EQ sound a little bit more washed out on the reverb. So it might add some low mids to try to fill in instead of extending the length or whatever. Like there's so much nuance to mixing that, like you said, I'm not really worried about that one. Like most of the AI tools that I actually have been very happy about is like feedback finders. So like somebody developed a plugin that actually helps find feedback. You just feed the speaker into the mic, this mic into the speaker,
live
and it
feedback.
Goes into a loop. You purposely cause the feedback and it will actually then search out what's ringing out, what the resonance is, and it'll actually start notching a few things out. But here's the thing. I still always have to figure it out myself, what I didn't like about it. Because if you've ever done AI mastering when it first started, you know that it didn't actually sound good. It was louder, but it didn't actually like sound any better, or it sometimes just didn't sound the same plus louder. It wasn't a very good resource at the time, maybe like, let's say 6 years ago. But now it's gotten a lot better. It's actually taking into account like the issues that it had before and has corrected and otherwise outperformed what it used to do. But it's still going to be a long way before we find AI really replacing any mixer for that matter. But this is really important. If you think that the reason that you're not going to get replaced with AI is because you have analog gear, you are sorely mistaken.
Yeah, that's one thing. Yep.
Yeah, because I just had this conversation with somebody who wants to buy like $40,000 worth of gear, and they want me to like broker the whole thing. And they asked me, like, is there anything on this list you wouldn't buy? I'm like, all of it. all of it. If I was in your shoes right now, I wouldn't buy any of it. Not because I don't believe in gear, but because I think you're buying it to kind of reassure yourself on some emotional level of what's going on.
You're compensating for an insecurity.
Yeah. It's not, yeah. And to be 100% honest with you, if I was in your shoe and I really wanted to buy gear because I want more gear, I would buy a rental system and rent it out, something that you don't even have to do. You could hire somebody else to push it out your damn door, but do something more productive, like practice your chops, get better at booking yourself out and setting a schedule and making calls to clients, do some cold calling, cold DMs, do anything else that actually makes you money. But if the reason you think people are booking you is your gear, you are not the product. Your gear is the product. And at the end of the day, your services is the product you're supposed to be pitching, not the gear you have. Because I hate to tell you, but depending on your distance, everybody else in LA has gear too. You might just be 5 minutes too far compared to the next guy. But if you have a better workflow, if you have a better understanding of what the client needs and what they're hoping out of the mix, and you're able to deliver on that better with a better sense of communication, distance is less of an issue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that being said, going back to the AI thing.
Mm-hmm.
If there is an AI that perfectly matches the process, the sounds of Manny Mariquin, does revisions and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that'll stop people from actually hiring Manny Mariquin?
No.
I don't think it will either.
No. Once again, even going back to what we said earlier, taste.
Yeah, and there's something also like psychological about the idea of like consumer psychology with like Manny Mariquin, all of these testimonials and how great it is, these past user experiences, it's free or it's mm-hmm. $10 versus Manny Mariquin, which is like thousands of dollars per mix.
Yeah.
People are still going to hire, you know, and the thing is people that were looking to hire the real Manny anyway, they... they're probably not in the demographic of people looking at AI.
Yeah.
Like they're not in the budget to have been thinking or considering AI.
Yeah.
So I'm saying this more for the sake of everybody listening right now to differentiate yourself and to make yourself different from AI. Is like you have to mix emotionally and you have to start analyzing. I think AI is going to force mixers to level up.
It's
going to raise.
Era.
It really will be. I think it will. Yeah. I really will be. And there's going to be some frustration. No, there's going to be a lot of frustration. There's going to be a lot of complaints. There's going to be a lot of people that lose their jobs. But I think that those that are seriously pursuing higher standards and more emotional intensity and storytelling with Sonics.
Mm-hmm.
I think those people are going to stand out and be able to charge more actually. And the people at the people that have become stagnant and I think that this will also lead the number one thought of that is like, okay, the barrier to entry will be slightly higher. That could be one possible interpretation, but the thing that I'm interested in is then the style of teaching and how we teach and what we teach and what we learn is actually the most important among mixers. And especially among the teachers and students will change as well. So the quality of teaching will change.
I'm sure you saw that ChatGPT had made their animation filter or whatever they want to call it for like photos and stuff. And a lot of people were like saying, oh, they mentioned trying to do like Studio Ghibli or Ghibli.
Ghibli.
Don't know
technically Ghibli? It's Ghibli, but in English it's Ghibli.
Okay. I'm going to call it Ghibli if it's technically right.
Yeah, that's Japanese. Ghibli.
Okay. Ghibli. But... you know, there was people who were for it saying like, oh, this is cool. This is fun, whatever. And then there was people who are like, we shouldn't be using this to kind of reanimate another artist's style, this and that. But the reality is that AI would not have gotten that style down unless somebody had been creative already and put the possibilities out there. So if an artist is looking for something new and they feel something and they can't really communicate it all that well, they're going to go to a professional who they trust, who has a similar sense of taste and they can actually speak to and actually say, hey, can we do this? Can we try that? Can we try that? AI really mostly re-performs things that it's been taught. It doesn't actually create anything out of thin air that's new and revolutionary. So
what
I think
is
this
it for
is why
This is a really good point.
Yeah.
And it's also the people that, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I totally cut you off. But I think this is a good example. And this is a whole different episode. I apologize. But I think it kind of still goes into this episode
said.
Here.
Yeah.
Is okay, this is fascinating. I love this example. I think it's a really low IQ argument to say that like it lowers the value of Ghibli. You need to pay for your art.
And it doesn't. If anything, it shows how many people love it.
Yeah, it actually raises the value of Ghibli. It does a couple things. People become more aware of Ghibli.
Yeah.
And then two, it forces, if anything, it forces Ghibli to level up or do something different, which is the entire point and experimentation of art. Yeah. Art is like, okay, and then just because AI can make another Ghibli movie doesn't diminish the value of the new original Ghibli film that will come out.
Yeah.
Like out of the mind of Miyazaki versus an AI generated one, there is some tangible difference and it doesn't necessarily lower the value. It might, but I actually would argue that it would potentially raise the value of Ghibli over time as well. Ethically, now, when it comes to ethics, that's a different conversation. But when we're talking about like economics and supply-demand, I don't think it totally changes the demand. I feel like it makes the demand higher.
What's funny is like if I were to talk to an artist about wanting to get a tattoo, but I want them to kind of be commissioned to make the tattoo design because I have something in my mind and I've seen their artwork before and I'm like, hey, can you make it something like this? I want to do that, blah, blah. They probably would actually get to the end goal faster than AI would because AI just has a reference of past works and what it interprets could possibly be done, but it's not coming up with a new, fresh take on this idea that you have that you're hoping to have commissioned. There is probably a proximity level where you're within a certain proximity of the end goal, but it's going to be a lot harder to refine than to have a conversation with the person whose art style you're trying to mimic. So like if you wanted something that's Studio Ghibli quality and a production on that level, guess who you got to hit up? Not AI. AI is just going to give you what is currently out there and what's available, but it's not really going to, you know, revolutionize the wheel or anything. You know, if you're looking to create something fresh and new with the support of what you love, then you would go to what you love.
This is a great example. And I'm very passionate about this because anybody that complains about this is underestimating and diminishing I think people that complain about this and say like pay artists, like don't endorse this sort of thing is actually diminishing my value. My value is not in my ability to recreate something. My value is my vision and my understanding, my sound, my taste. And for people to virtue signal and say that AI is bad and stand on my behalf is diminishing how different and tasteful that I am compared to machine. I am much better than a machine. And don't ever try to use my creative taste and endeavor and say that AI is diminishing it because I am much more creative than a machine can be, especially one that needs to be fed something. Okay.
That's why they call it a language model. You have to teach it.
This is exactly why there's two perfect metaphors that go with mixing of what makes us different from a machine, which is kind of the unintentional ending of this episode, is this last week, or 2 months ago, I wanted to hire someone a specific artist that I like, that I've worked with in the past, to recreate a new logo for my new website that I'm building, right?
I think I saw it recently.
Yeah, sure. That I rebuilt my website. You can go to dkmixes.com and look at the current iteration of my website right now, and how I've changed it, and the color schemes, and the textures, etc. Okay, so I have this artist that I love that I've worked with in the past. She just had a baby, and I have to wait 3 months before she asked me to wait 3 months before I reach out to her again and potentially hire her for recreating my logo. In the meantime, I'm waiting, sitting on my ass for 3 months. So I asked AI, be like, hey, here's my Pinterest board. Here's some ideas that I have. Here's the styles, and like dictate as much as I want. To be like, hey, here's this, and there's logos. And it came out with some sweet new logo design options. That's awesome. Am I still considering not hiring this lady? No, not at all, because she does something that's unique to her and she has a vision that AI cannot do, nor can I describe that like she will do in the moment. Mm-hmm. And if I ask her now and if I ask her 10 months from now and if I give her one more different reference, her style and interpretation of said logo will completely change.
Yeah.
It's a living, breathing human. It didn't lower her value. If anything, it raised her value because now I'm willing to pay more for her taste because I could just get regular logos online generated. Yeah. Same thing with I saw a Twitter post, an X post of a guy that took a picture of his messy living room and says, hey, can you do some interior design? The TV has to stay where it is and the couch has to stay where it is. And the image generated an image, a real photorealistic image, and it generated the image of his room, but with furniture and things that looked good. Does that stop that person? And then the quote was, oh, interior designers is now a job that is gone. Disappeared job.
That's not true.
No, that's not true at all. Because if you have a niche and if you have a good taste, that AI, even if they can replicate, can you replicate the taste of a Marie Kondo type interior design interior? Mm-hmm. The AI will do what thinks Marie Kondo does. Does it diminish the value of Marie Kondo and her interior design taste?
Yeah.
No. Especially in the sake of art, because in the sake of art, it's about her doing it. It's about the artist. And art is, okay, I'm getting ahead of myself.
No,
it doesn't.
You're
absolutely doesn't. It doesn't at all.
Yeah.
And the fact that people are fearful of it, I think is belittling the creator and the artist. Isn't fearful? They're using the fear of AI as a way to virtue signal in defense of real art. But it's if you really believed it was real art, there's no need to defend it.
Yeah. So one of the ways that I was actually on this topic with one of my friends is basically he asked if I was scared to not be hired anymore to help design and plan and build studios. Because with AI, technically, if you wanted to soundproof a space, you could just ask it how to soundproof the most effectively my living room, and I've actually had these conversations on reverb.com. It's the eBay of musical instruments. If you've never used reverb.com, it's not a website dedicated to reverb. The funny thing is a lot of people are using AI as a source of information and kind of just looking for options, looking for tools, this and that. And then they take AI's output and then they go online and they look for whatever those tools are, hoping to kind of solve the problem. But right now I'm selling this mini DSP Flex HD unit. I have one left over from a project. And a guy was asking me, he's like, hey, can this thing do 24 decibels per octave, this and that, blah, blah, blah. And once I started asking him questions about what he's looking to do, it turns out AI was telling him to use it on his guitar pedal rig. And I'm like, no, you don't want this. The amount of latency you would get from it is closer to about 10 to 15 milliseconds, which is going to affect your playability. And you're also feeding unbalanced into a balanced input. And then even then you wouldn't run this thing into your guitar amp and this and that. It's just not going to work out the way you think. He's like, oh, but AI told me that this would work. And so I'm like, well, there's nuances to everything we do. So if you're looking for somebody that's going to design a space for you, like an interior designer, they might say, hey, this couch is actually really good for this kind of style for this reason. And it actually fits in your budget. AI is just going to show you a picture of a nice couch that maybe doesn't actually exist or maybe way out of budget, this and that. But it also may not take into account your lifestyle. Do you always have visitors? Do you like to play video games? Do you like this? Do you like that? Interior designers take your life into account with how they plan your space out. If you hire a studio to go and record at, they might take into account how you like to approach the start of your day as to how they prepare your room. Do they always have writers? They always like two SM7Bs in the back. That's cool. But how do they like their reverbs? How do they like their delays on the scratch vocals versus when they go into the booth and actually record the actual vocal? There's a lot of things that AI is useful for right now, but creativity is one of those things that it's going to have to battle for at least another decade, at least.
And hear me, I'm not even talking about the technology of it, which is a bad argument, I think.
Yeah.
No offense.
Technology is good.
No, because it will get better. Technology can always get better.
Yeah.
But let's talk about human to human. Mm-hmm. If you love jazz, you can go on Spotify. Go to YouTube. Listen to jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Why do people still pay to go to jazz clubs?
Human interaction, the vibe.
Huh?
Everything. Literally.
Wait, but a jazz club is a two-drink minimum and you might have to get food. It's literally could be $50 to $100 per person.
There might be two drinks
jazz
for me
is,
already.
Jazz is free, made by other humans.
Yeah.
why do you still need to go to a jazz club? Yeah. That's how dumb the AI argument is. Doesn't make sense. All right. Okay, I think that's so the point is focus on what's important, be human, focus on your art.
Yeah.
Focus on your art and the emotions. I think this is a good episode. All right. On that note, happy mixing, my friends, and stay saucy.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a UnitedHealthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
If you love the Mixing Music Podcast but want deeper, ad-free, technical episodes, we've got you covered. Our Patreon gives you access to over 250 exclusive episodes and new content every single week, all focused on mixing, mastering, and engineering at a high level. For just $4 a month, you get practical tips and techniques that will instantly improve your sound. Join now at mixingmusicpodcast.com/exclusive.